Hi, everybody. Dennis Prager. Wow, you are meeting Mr. Tubbs. Not the first time, I acknowledge, but rare. A rare Mr. Tubbs sighting. You have no idea how much my wife worked to get him into this bed. And so far, it's a good minute and a half, I would say, that he's been in there. All right, a lot to talk to you about and take your questions. Thank you for being with me. So last week, I spoke about how few American students, and I suspect this is true almost universally, know about evil, know about how much evil took place in the 20th century. I mentioned that 45% couldn't even identify Auschwitz, the largest Nazi death camp, and probably 80% couldn't identify Gulag, where Stalin killed tens of millions of Soviet citizens, and so on. So I have a related subject, and you can go on the internet and see my column on this subject. It's one this week. It's fascinating for me to see the reactions people have. I always read comments, not just on my own articles, but on any article on a subject that is of great interest to me. I titled the article, "What Does God Most Care About?" I want to make sure that that is the exact title. What does God most care about? Yes, that's what I wrote about. And I have an answer, and it's really important whether you are secular or religious. Not everybody agrees with me, that's fine, but I'd like to make the case that God most cares about good and evil. More than anything else, God cares about how his creatures treat each other. His creatures are us. And I give about 10 different arguments. I will give you a few of them now. It's clearly important because I don't think a lot of religious people have taught that God cares most about how you treat your fellow human being. A lot of people have taught that God cares most often about something else, theology, ritual, worship, I mean, a whole host of things. So let me give you argument number one. Every society that I know of, every ancient society of which I am aware, had a flood story, or as anthropologists call it, a flood myth. A story about how the gods, it was always the gods, destroyed the world and started all over, usually with an individual, sometimes with a group, sometimes with two individuals, whatever it might be. There is such a flood story. Of course, the most famous one is in the Bible, when Noah was saved. That's Noah's Ark. Why did God in the Bible, I don't care if you believe in the story or not, as literal, it doesn't matter to me. The lesson is what matters to me. What is being taught matters to me. Why did God destroy the world? It says so. Because it was filled with people doing evil toward one another. That's why. The land was filled with Hamas. Hamas is a Hebrew word often meaning violence. Evil is obviously the intended term. That's why God destroys the world, because it was filled with evil. By the way, that was unique. Of all the stories I have read, that was the one that only emphasized the moral issue, evil. Here's an example. The most famous flood story from the same part of the world at the same time was in Mesopotamia. At the same time that the Bible was written, or at least Genesis was written, about 3,200 years ago, or whatever you dated, 3,000 years ago, it doesn't matter. At about that time in Mesopotamia, there was a story called the Epic of Gilgamesh. And the gods destroyed the world then too. But you know why? You'll love this. You will truly love this. Human beings were making too much noise, and it kept the gods awake. Is that awesome? That is one sophisticated theology. Yeah, I think, Joe, I think we'll get rid of humanity. They're making much too much noise. You know, we're stuck on the bottom apartment. We hear everybody above us. I guess we're stuck on the top apartment and hear everybody below us, to be more precise. And it's always cracked me up that is the reason. But that is the reason. You could check it out. I've checked it out multiple times. And then comes along the Hebrew Bible and says, no, God cares about how people treat each other. Argument number two. Who was saved? Noah and his family. Why is Noah saved? Because he's a good man. And Noah was a righteous man in his generations. Often in other stories, there are a whole host of other reasons why who was ever saved is saved. They did a God a favor. The God liked them. The person was a handsome man. But just moral, he was a good person. I couldn't find that in another story. Argument number three, and you could find this on the internet, What Does God Most Care About by Dennis Prager. Number three, God is repeatedly described as a moral being. Here's an example. God is not partial, takes no bribe, executes justice for the orphan and the widow, loves the stranger, provides them with food and clothing, from Deuteronomy, the fifth book of the Bible. I have a commentary on the book of Deuteronomy. It's the third of my five-volume series on the Torah, the first five books. Constantly, God is described as good because that's the most important thing you can be. Number four, the fundamental human division in the Hebrew Bible is not between the Jew and the non-Jew, but between good people and bad people. That's why so many non-Jews are described so positively in the Hebrew Bible. You know who saves Moses? The daughter of Pharaoh. The Pharaoh ordered that the baby Hebrew boys be drowned in the Nile. Moses was put in a little ark. It's the same word as Noah's Ark, interestingly, in a little box, and floated down the Nile by his mom. And the daughter of Pharaoh saves him. Imagine that. You imagine how Pharaoh was hated by the ancient Israelites, and they depicted the daughter of the Pharaoh as a saintly human being. Because it just divides. That's the key. The major division in the human race is not between religions. It's not between ethnicities. It's not between races. It's not between the sexes. It's between the decent and the indecent. That has been the motto of my life. I got it first from the Bible, from the Hebrew Bible specifically, and then I got it from Viktor Frankl. Viktor Frankl was not a religious man. He was a secular Jew. He was in the Holocaust. He was an Austrian Jewish psychoanalyst. His wife and other family members were slaughtered by the Nazis. He was asked after the war, this is all in one of the 10 books that most influenced me, Man's Search for Meaning. Frankl is spelled F-R-A-N-K-L. He was asked, do you hate the German race? And his answer shook me up. I read it in high school. He said, no, there are only two races, the decent and the indecent. That is how I divide the world. That's why I have such contempt for leftism. It doesn't divide the world between good and bad. It divides the world between rich and poor. That's how Marx divided it. That's how every communist regime has divided it. That's how the left still divides it. And between colors, black and white. But who gives a damn if you're black, or who gives a damn if you're white, other than the left and the Ku Klux Klan? Who cares? The only thing that matters is exactly what Martin Luther King said and what Viktor Frankl said, your character. That's the division that matters, the decent and the indecent. I mean, it's so obvious that it's painful that I even have to talk about it. Let's imagine you're white. Okay, you're watching this and you're white. Do you know any bad whites? I'll bet you do. Let's say you're black. Do you know any bad blacks? I'll bet you do. So what's the division that matters? If you're black and you're watching this, are you closer to a good white or a bad black? If you're a white watching this, are you closer to a bad white or a good black? I mean, the question, I feel silly having to ask it, but that is what the left has done. Like that division matters? This is all from the Hebrew Bible. That's the division that matters. Argument number 5. The Hebrew Bible, therefore, God is preoccupied with the treatment of animals. Morality includes how you treat an animal. You know that animals made it into the Ten Commandments? Most people have no idea about that. Just as you're commanded to rest on the Sabbath day, so is your animal. There are so many laws pertaining to animals, people don't even know it. You can't put two animals of different species on the same plow because they're different sizes and they walk at different speeds, so they'll pull at each other. Or you are not allowed to muzzle an ox while it works in the fields. It has to be free to eat the whole time it's working. These are biblical laws. Number 6. The prophets, a major part of the Old Testament, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Micah, so on, Ezekiel, they are preoccupied with what? Moral behavior. How do you treat other people? And God is repeatedly depicted as more concerned with moral behavior than with anything else. This is biblical. Ready? From Micah. God has told you, O man, O human being, the word for human being is used, not man even, Adam, the word, it's fascinating. So it's universal. What is good and what the Lord demands of you only, this is amazing. I translated it because I know this Hebrew very well. They don't always use only, but that's what it means. Only to do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with your God. Here's another one from the prophet Amos. Hate evil and love good and establish justice. This is all in the name of God. And my favorite verse from the whole Bible, from Psalms, those of you who love God must hate evil. It's a command. Hebrew has a command form in the verb. It's a commandment. You must hate evil. If you don't hate evil, you don't love God. Okay, so do rabbis, priests, and ministers, do they teach this? This is what God most demands of you, or do they teach something else? This is not the only thing God demands of us. He wants us to be holy. He wants us to do a whole host of things. But the most important is how we treat another human being. We're all God's children. Parents care how their children treat each other. Okay, we're good. And now, ladies and gentlemen, to our video question.
How's it going? Dennis, CJ here from PragerU. Wanted to ask you a quick question. What do you think is actually a bigger threat? The decline in masculinity when it comes to men, or the decline in femininity when it comes to women?
So here is a lesson I have learned in the course of my long career in radio and in public speaking. Whenever someone says, here's a quick question, I'm dead. Because the question may be quick, but the answer is not. There's never a quick question is how are you? But nobody prefaces how are you. Here's a quick question. I already start to shudder when I hear here's a quick question. I know I'm in for something really rough. That actually, I have to commend you, CJ. You should all watch CJ at PragerU. I've actually, in all seriousness, I've thought about that a lot. which came first, but I think this is a chicken and egg issue. Which came first, the decline in masculinity or the decline in femininity? And I can make a case for both. My suspicion is that when men stop being masculine, women get quite confused. So if I had to choose which leads to the other more likely, it is men. The abandonment of masculinity on the part of men sort of upsets the whole apple cart. And then women sort of try to fill in that blank area, that hole that is created by the absence of the masculine man. But she's not made to do that. She is made to be with a masculine man. And that enables her to be the woman that she wants to be. Of course, this is laughed at by the left. They laugh at everything profound and mature because it upsets them. But I could live with that. The question is not, is it upsetting? The question is it true? I would say that I think that's the catastrophic loss that leads to the other catastrophic loss. Women want men to be masculine. In fact, men want men to be masculine. So we're paying a big price. By the way, it's not easy for many men to be masculine. If it were, every man would be masculine. It's not easy to develop in almost any arena. It's not easy to play the piano. It's not easy to do a sport well. Tell me what is worthwhile that's easy. It's easy to sit in your house or your parents' house, more likely, and play video games. That's easy. It's easy not to take responsibility for a family. That's really easy. It's easier not to get married. It's easier not to be a parent. That's correct. And then you get old, and you look back at your life, and you can say, I didn't do anything difficult. I am so happy. No family, no spouse, no particular achievement, but I got damn good at video games. It's funny, I have so often said that I don't want my tombstone to read, here lies Dennis Prager. He avoided as much pain as possible. I don't think that that's an achievement. It's funny that we recognize in working out no pain, no gain. Why don't we recognize that in all of life? That's a rule for all of life, no pain, no gain. And again, the best, wisest book of all, already said it 3,000 or 2,500 years ago. Those who sow in tears will reap in joy. That's the same as no pain, no gain. You want to reap in joy? You have to sow in tears. Okay, next. From the internet, how often do you think about the Roman Empire? I saw an Instagram reel that said something along the lines of, women have no idea how often the men in their lives think about the Roman Empire. So I asked my husband, how often do you think about the Roman Empire? And without missing a beat, he said, every day. Y'all, why? So I have been following this. I have no idea what they're talking about. It's like the first time in my life I'm wondering, am I a male? How often do I think about the Roman Empire? Pretty rarely. I think about the Roman Empire. Well, I taught Jewish history at Brooklyn College many years ago, and so I obviously had to teach about Roman history. And I am painfully aware of the Gladiator Games. But otherwise, I can't say that Roman history impinges much on my thinking process. Do you understand this whole issue? Ask Nate the Great. Be honest. How often do you think of the Roman Empire?
A couple times a month.
Is that true?
I grilled him before this and made him really think about it.
Wait, he said a couple of times a month? Really? What about you?
I'd say a couple times a week.
Wait, are you serious?
As of late.
Oh, as of late. Oh, now I think of it every day because of this nonsense. Okay, so how often do you think of the Greek Empire?
Never.
Okay, all right, hello. Hello, there's a little... about the Assyrian Empire. How about the Mughals in India? Okay. British Empire. That's more recent. Actually, I do think of the British Empire. I don't know, about twice a month. Okay, so I'm going to put Nate on the spot. Twice a month you think about the Roman Empire? Okay. Any time in the last couple of months, what exactly did you think about the Roman Empire?
I mean, I think it's basically a reflection on kind of what our society is right now.
Decline, an empire. Okay, that's interesting. Is that you too?
Yeah, I'd say so, probably. Yeah. More about, are we going to last as long as Rome?
Yeah, are we doing the same?
Oh, that's fascinating. Okay, I'm very happy I asked. Asking why always helps. That makes perfect sense. So I think, sadly, we're in decline. Not a decline that can't be stopped, but we are. The left is doing to America what the barbarians did to the Roman Empire. But I don't use that reference point when I think about it. I just think we're in trouble. I don't think we're in trouble like the Roman Empire was in trouble. I'm not saying it's not a valid thought. I'll tell you, though, an immediate reason why I think there's a difference. And of course, I know you know there are differences, too. But the Romans did a lot of good things. I mean, they built roads. They built sanitation. I mean, and this is not insignificant. They had some great literature. They preserved Greek works. But there was a staggering amount of cruelty that was at the heart of the Roman Empire, the heart. Gladiators were an example where the emperor would have people go for entertainment to watch people torture to death, to watch women raped by animals. I mean, if you read about the gladiator events, I mean, it's pure sadism in the purest sense of the word. Watching men battle till they killed each other. So we're not like that. We're the first example of a good society committing suicide. That's a very big difference. This is unique. This is not Rome. This is the most decent society created. Yes, I'm well aware, very well aware of slavery and Jim Crow. I'm very well aware of a lot of defects historically in America. But I don't compare America to utopia. I compare it to other countries. There's a reason 4 million blacks have moved to the United States in the last few decades from Africa and the Caribbean. It's because they know how good it is. They know how good it is to be a black or a white or an Asian or you name it in the United States of America. There was the most famous rabbi of the 20th century, Menachem Schneerson, known as the Lubavitcher Rabbi, the head of Chabad, the great Jewish movement. He came to America, I think, in the 1940s. He came from a terrible persecution in Europe. And he declared, and he was aware of anti-Semitism in America, but he declared to his many followers, and he, As I said, he was the most prominent rabbi of the 20th century, Orthodox man, bearded Orthodox man. And he said, and I know what he said because I know the Hebrew. He said, it's a Medina shel Chesed. America is a country of kindness. And he knew that there were places he couldn't buy a house because he was a Jew. He knew that there were law firms that didn't allow Jews in them. He knew that Harvard had a quota on Jews and so on. But he was right, because he knew what real anti-Semitism was. He didn't compare America to a perfect society. He compared America to other countries. That's a big difference. That's why I don't think about Rome when I think about decline. I think about the unique thing that the left is doing. It is killing a good society. That's what's so amazing. That's why the sin is that great. By the left, I don't mean liberals. Liberals vote for the left, but liberals don't think like the left. I always make that distinction. The average liberal does not believe that a 16-year-old or an 18-year-old should have her healthy breast cut off because she says she's a boy. All leftists do believe that. Leftists believe that men who say they're women can compete against women in women's sports. Liberals don't believe that. I mean, leftists believe in all black dormitories. Liberals believe in racial integration, not racial segregation. Liberals know America is flawed, but basically, my country, tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. God bless America. That's what the liberal thinks. It's not how the leftist thinks. The leftist thinks that you should take a knee when the national anthem is played before a sporting event. The list is very long. So that's why I don't think of the Roman Empire as much as others might. A society that venerated cruelty was in decline. This is a society that venerated goodness and is in decline. That's a very amazing difference. What's our timing?
We're at the end.
We're already there. Another intense and fun fireside chat. This was 307. Your homework assignment is to watch numbers 14, 173. It must be fun, actually. It's sort of a diary of the time we live in, the fireside chats.
Yeah, it is.
To think that we did fireside chats throughout lockdown time. I never say COVID, I always go lockdown. So I do commend that to your attention to go back and look at others. Thanks for watching. I'll see you next week.
Thank you for watching this video. To keep PragerU videos free, please consider making a tax-deductible donation.